Okay, y'all are up and ready, and can I just say I am impressed on a Tuesday morning at how many of you are here. Just for me, out of curiosity, how many of you have been here for every session? That's pretty impressive. Well, you had a doctor's appointment, and you know how they are. If you don't make it, they just tell you got to wait 6 months to come see them again. Yeah, so you better take it while you've got it. I might be back before you get in to see him again. Well, it is good to have a Tuesday morning and to be able to spend it jumping into the Word. And, you know, one of the things that we need to remember when we have these opportunities, because we don't get them that often, really. And when the Lord gives us an opportunity, which is a key word for us today with this church, when the Lord gives us an opportunity where he wipes the calendar clean for a day or so and you've got a couple hours that you don't normally have to be able to spend digging into his word, having some fellowship with brothers and sisters, and just having that time out of your regular routine, don't waste these times. This is pretty valuable. You know, when the pastor looks at the church calendar and he tries to figure out what do we need, it's a blessing when he puts on there specifically, this is time that we're going to just set other stuff aside and focus on listening to the Lord through his word and through his spirit. So we don't want to waste these special times. We don't get them all the time, do we, Dale? No. So thank God for them when they come. All righty. So we are moving right along. We have done Ephesus Sunday morning, Smyrna Sunday night. Last night we did Pergamum. Yesterday morning, Thyatira. So guess who's this morning? Philadelphia, because I'm messing you up. We're doing Philadelphia this morning, and we'll do Sardis tonight. And some of the reasons for that is these two had some similarities, and so I put one in the morning and one in the evening. And then with these two, this one I just really wanted to do in an evening. But Philadelphia is one of the favorites. This is, and this is, I don't know if Brother B told you this, but y'all are my guinea pigs for this series of teaching. I'm writing a full curriculum on it, and when it's done, it'll be 13 weeks long. So I'm practicing on y'all. So you're getting the rough draft. So I appreciate your patience with the rough draft as we work through this, and we'll just work on it together. So we remember, as we're learning, we've got our first three ESP, and then TSP, and then L. And that's our little trick to remember. So we're going to take those away. And who is ready to say all seven churches in order? ESP, TSPL. I know that you're here and you've been practicing and now you're chomping at the bit. Nathan, I just see it just boiling out of you. It's in there. You want to try it? Did you see that? It just flowed out of him like nothing. So you want to stick Philadelphia on there? And when I was picking up at Philadelphia, I found this is a piece of pottery. I have no idea how old it was, but I found it in the ruins there at Philadelphia and stuck it in my pocket. And the Turkish gentleman that I was with, I did tell him, I'm picking these rocks up. And he said, I didn't see a thing, did you? And so again, thank you. So again, if they come and arrest Brother B, you can blame me. Alrighty, so Philadelphia is unique in our churches as we look at the common elements in the letters, which we're going to go through again, and yes, we'll go through it again tonight and tomorrow night. And it's not that I want to bore you, I want to get to the place where when I'm doing it, you already know what's coming, because that means that you've learned and you've picked something up. So the more I say it, the more it's in your mind. Even if you find, oh my goodness, here she goes again, the fact that you can say, I can finish this sentence for her, that tells me that you learned. So that makes me happy. So we have all in our beginning of the letters, we have all of them where the speaker tells us, describes himself, and who is the speaker? Jesus. It's not John. John's doing the dictation. He's writing it down. But Jesus is the speaker. And then he starts off with the knowledge that he has of that church. And haven't you been amazed at how personal His knowledge is. It's like he's already read their history. Imagine that, that the one who is the same yesterday, today, and forever knows the history. You think he knows the history of this country? Sees all, knows all, and he doesn't forget it. He knows the history of Louisiana. He knows the history of Point. Ain't nobody knows the history of Point, Louisiana, but God does. And probably a few of you. I think Brother B's lived through half of it, haven't you? Pretty close. Your strengths, he's going to tell them what they do well, and then your needs. Now, this letter that we have here, Philadelphia, is unique with one other church, Smyrna, in that there is nothing that the Lord condemns. The entire letter is praiseworthy. Can you imagine standing before the Lord one day? And as he looks down at you, he says, "Well done, good and faithful. Enter into the joy of the Lord." And that's the end of the sentence. I think some of us, we stay awake at night wondering what he's going to say. Especially for those of us in leadership. I know for me, as I pastored for 25 years. And as a pastor, the kind of things that keep me awake at night were those verses that said that the leaders watch for your souls as they that must give an account before God. That keeps pastors up at night, knowing they're going to have to give an account for you. Would you want to give an account for you? Yeah. Oh, but to hear the well done, and that's what this church will hear. So we're not going to find any needs listed. That doesn't mean there aren't any needs there. It doesn't mean they were perfect. It simply means that what the Lord sees at this point, all he's seeing is the strengths. And then he's going to give them some counsel. There's no warning in this letter, but there is a pretty good promise. And then, of course, the ending, and everybody can say it together right now. He that hath an ear to hear, let him to the churches. You guys are awesome. So there's an individual message with the he, and then there's a plural with the churches. So we ready to get rolling on Philadelphia? Now, we're going to try something this morning that I couldn't get to work on my computer, and I finally figured out, well, that might be because of the internet situation. So I brought it over here and tried it on Pastor B's, and it worked. While I was in Turkey visiting all of these cities, I made a video reading the letter from that city. And so we're going to try to show that one this morning. And Pastor B had asked me last night about head coverings, and so you'll notice that around my neck, I have some pulled down because I wore a head covering most of the time when I was there. I pulled it down, and it's around my neck. And I'll admit that I kind of fell in love with head coverings while I was there. You don't have to do your hair. The wind doesn't blow you, and some of them are beautiful. But I've pulled that down so it doesn't distract while we're reading. So we're going to try that and just see what happens. Oh, but first we're going to give, you know what, let's go ahead and go straight to that video, and then we'll come back to this. You need to press that, yeah.
And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia, write, "He who is holy, who is true, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, and who shuts and no one opens, says this, I know your deeds. Behold, I have put before you an open door which no one can shut. Because you have a little power and have kept my word and have not denied my name. Behold, I will cause those of the synagogue of Satan who say that they are Jews and are not but lies. I will make them come and bow down at your feet and make them know that I have loved you. Because you have kept the word of my perseverance, I also will keep you from the hour of testing, that hour which is about to come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. I am coming quickly. Hold fast what you have so that no one will take your crown. He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he will not go out from it anymore. And I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and my new name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches.
Now, I particularly wanted to use this video because of the background noise. Because most of the ones that I made don't have background noise because I'm standing out in a ruin somewhere away from civilization. But Philadelphia is right smack in the middle of a thriving city. So you can't see it here because I just look like I'm, you see those ruins right there. But this is right in the middle of a downtown. All around this, it's like one block area that they've excavated. And all around this is a thriving city. So you hear the trucks going by. I'm right in the middle of downtown at the only things that are left. And when I tell you what the only things that are left are, you're going to just go, wow, because I just think it's cool. Smyrna is also a thriving city. It's actually the third largest city. It's Izmir today. But the third largest city in Turkey after Istanbul and then Ankara, the capital, and then Smyrna, Izmir. And Philadelphia, also a thriving city. The other city that's still thriving, where you find the ruins in the middle of a city, is Thyatira. I just think that's fascinating. One of the issues that the Turkish government has, because there's a lot of things of these cities that are still underground and haven't been found. Because one of the things that we need to remember, when the Ottoman Turks swept across Turkey, let's go back to our little map there. When the Ottoman Turks swept across Turkey, coming up from around here and coming into all of this area and taking these cities one by one, coming up until they got up here to Constantinople in 1453. They started down here and then moved up. And what they did was as they destroy the city, then you rebuild on top of the destruction. And so archaeologically, these ancient remains are underneath cities that were built on top of them. Now, the ones that were never rebuilt, like Ephesus, Laodicea, they were never rebuilt. And so to dig down, you can find these cities and bring them up. But if there's a city underneath a city that's thriving, here's what happens. Nobody wants to dig. Because the government rule is, if you're digging and you find these ancient artifacts, you stop. Everything stops. You have to report it to the government. They have to come in and they take over. Now, let me just say this. If you're putting in a new basement at your house and you dig and you find this old piece of pottery, just a little bitty piece of pottery, if you report that to the government, your work stops, and they come in, and they take over, and they may tear down your house and dig that. So what happens is that it's not that there's not things under there being found. It's just that people don't report them. Because once you report them, you've just lost your property, your whole thing. And so there's a ton of undiscovered stuff sitting underneath these cities, including this little city here in Philadelphia. So here's where we are. And this is a unique place, and I didn't get to put the other map up that I wanted to show you of one of the things that makes it unique, because without internet I couldn't pull it up. I should have done it when I got here to the church. But you see these kingdoms here, Lycia and Mysia and then Phrygia, and then over here we've got Lydia. One of the unique things that you don't see on the map, because this is a road map, one of the things that you don't see is that Philadelphia is a very unique spot because it is right on the border of three different kingdoms. Phrygia, Mysia comes down to here. Over here is Lydia. And then down here you got, but right here, three different kingdoms meet. And this is actually the youngest one of our cities. Every city has a beginning. Somebody has to found it. This is the youngest one of our cities. It was founded only 200 years before Christ. So some of these other cities are going back, 4,000 years before. They've got remains from the Hittite kingdom and all of that. Not Philadelphia. It is a young city, and it was built with a specific purpose. You remember that we talked about the Attalid kingdom and all of those. One of those Attalid kings, King Eumenes, when some of the other people had risen up against him, his brother fought right beside him. His brother's name was Attalus. And he was so proud of his brother and the loyalty that he showed, that he built a city and he named it after his brother. But he didn't want to name the city Eumenes because that just didn't sound like a good city name. So instead, he picked two words and he put them together as a compound word. The words were brother, because he was building it for his brother, and the other one was phileo, love, the love of a brother. And so that's where they got the name Philadelphia. Isn't that cool?
Yes.
That, you know, you just name a city after your brother. And we want to be the kind of brother that if our sibling named a city after us, it would be a nice name. Not all of our siblings, if they named us, they would have named my city the Runt. Yeah, because I'm the baby, 10 years younger. I would have been the Runt city. But this one named it Brotherly Love. It lays at the borders of these three kingdoms. And it was built with the intention of being a missionary city for the Hellenistic culture of the Lydian kingdom. And so it's right there on the border of these three. And when the king built this city, it was because it's on the border, it was going to be a place where he would be able to showcase the beauty of the Greek lifestyle to all of these other places around it. Let's go back to that map. All of these other things out here that are more east, they'd be able to look to this city he's building and say, wow, what a great lifestyle. So when people would travel there, they'd see the glories of the Hellenistic kingdom, and they would say, I want to be like that. It was built with the intention of spreading a certain culture, to evangelize, if you would, for a certain culture, for the Greek culture of the Lydian kingdom. And so that's its history. Not a bad start, would you say?
Yeah.
Now, it was also a successful commercial center. And there's some unique things about this. Because, you know, sometimes, have you ever bought yourself a house or something and you found out some things after you bought it that you would have liked to have known before you bought it? And that was true of this city. I mean, all the intentions were good. This looks, it's a fertile valley. But sometimes there's things you just don't know that you'd find out after you move in. And one of the things that they found out after they moved in is that this little valley right along here happens to have a lot of volcanic activity. Now, in some ways, that was good. Here's the good news, because this is like when the real estate agent is talking to you about your property you get, he says, well, here's the good news and here's the bad news. Well, the bad news is there's volcanic activity. But the good news is that all that ash that's been laying here all this time makes it really, really fertile for vineyards. And you can grow some great grapes. And you can sell this wine all over the area, and you'll make some money selling wine. Won't that be great? And, oh, yeah, I want to own that. That's great. And so they come in and they have these fertile, and of course, since it's a fertile valley, what God are we going to have be our patron God if we're going to be a valley of wine? Who do we want to be our patron God? We had him last night. That guy, right? Dionysus, the God of wine and revelry. So he is the patron God of the city of Philadelphia. So the real estate says to you, well, I got good news. You know, you got a lot of vineyard here, but I got some bad news too. That volcanic activity, while it makes it really fertile, you're also going to have, just the occasional earthquake. Don't worry about it. They're usually really small. And, you know, it's like the guy that says, it only floods here every 70 years, but the last flood was 69 years ago. He doesn't tell you that. And that's kind of what we've got going on here. So a lot of earthquakes that happen. And in AD 17, the mother of all earthquakes hit this area, completely destroying the city of Philadelphia, just leveled the entire thing. But here's some good news. You got bad news. Earthquake's going to level your city. However, the good news is that Emperor Tiberius is going to feel generous because you produce so much wealth and all of this really great wine. He is going to give you a huge sum of money to rebuild your city. And he's not going to charge you any taxes for 5 years. Now, how many of you would like to know that you are going to get a whole bunch of money and no taxes for 5 years? Not a bad deal, yes. So there's good news. So they rebuild the city. But the issue is that this mother of all earthquakes, for several years after this, the aftershocks were almost daily for several decades. And so what happened to the city of Philadelphia is that it developed a practice of building, rebuilding, and when an aftershock would come, because you're rebuilding, and when you look at you know, how they're building, you get an aftershock from an earthquake. You don't want to be around stuff like that, right? And so people would flee from the city, move out into the outlying country area for a while until the aftershock stopped, and then move back into the city, do a little more building, and then next aftershock they move out and then they move back in. Now people might ask, why on earth would you live in a place like that? Well, y'all are in Louisiana. The rest of the nation asked that to New Orleans. Did y'all know that? They looked down at New Orleans and said, why do you continue to rebuild this city? Because it's home. This is my city, and I have put my foot here, and this is where my family is, this is my home. So Philadelphia was constantly in that thing of, are we going to need to rush? Now, some people would stay in the city and just weather out all the aftershocks, and some people would leave. But it was a consistent, unstable situation. And so what we find here is that it also, in this city, in the little bits that we have, the only things remaining that have been found in this about city block area are pillars. And so there's some things that we know about the customs of the city from these pillars that have been found. So when I was reading that passage, I'm standing right here in front of that pillar. And the things that they found archaeologically with these pillars, that it was a custom to reward the faithful public servant. After they died, they would build a pillar in one of the temples, and they would inscribe their name on it so that they would never be forgotten. So let's say that you're the mayor of the city and you've done a really good job. And when you die, then they erect a big pillar, put it in the temple, write your name and all your accomplishments on it, so that for years to come, your kids, your grandkids, all the neighbors' kids, when they come through, your name will live as long as that pillar stands. Pretty cool. So some of these guys today, 2,000 years later, we know who they are, because they had a pillar that was placed into the town with their name on it and their accomplishments, which is really pretty cool. And so then we've read our passage. So let's jump into the passage. We don't know exactly how the church was founded. One tradition from early church history says that it was Paul's nephew, a little-known guy in the book of Acts. Paul's nephew warns him one time when there's a possible attack on him, and he leaves, escapes in a basket. There is a document that says that Paul sent his nephew, Lucius, to the city of Philadelphia when he was on a mission trip and sent him to start a church there. But there's another document that is just a little bit later that says that John the Apostle, when he was in Ephesus, he sent a man by the name of, I wrote his name down here, Demetrius, to start a church. So if it was started by Lucius, it was a little earlier in the book of Acts, and if it was started by John sending this other guy, what matters is that somebody started it. Yeah. Because by the time we get to this point, James, it's here. And I'll tell you, if something's here, somebody started it. Everything has a history. So let's just jump into this letter of undiluted praise. And I like that word, undiluted. Do you remember the old Dove soap commercials that it was 99 point something something percent pure? Oh, that was Ivory. Thank you. I have to write that down so I get the right thing. Ivory, that's right, it was. Ivory soap. Had that little baby on it. Right. And it was undiluted. It was all pure. Now, in these letters that we've been reading, most of them, not all, but most of them start with some pretty good praise. We were really impressed with Ephesus until we got to that word but. And that put a whole new light on all that other stuff. But this letter, undiluted. There's no but that we're going to come across to when we get to it. Undiluted praise. Even better than ivory soap. And here's how the sender of the letter, Jesus, describes himself. He tells us four things about himself here. First, he says, he who is holy, who is true, who has the key, who opens, who shuts, says this. So we see some things here. We see his character. We see that the one who is speaking to this church, his essence is complete holiness. Complete. Now, not ivory soap holy, 99 point, but 100% and without variableness. He is holy because that is who he is. Now, that's a little hard for us to grasp, to say, well, I'm holy because that's who I am. We think, okay, but to help us understand, we have to go into some logic kind of thinking. Here's an example. In the scripture, it says that God cannot lie, right? We're familiar with that. Now, why can't God lie? I can lie. Deanie can lie. We're able to lie. It says God cannot lie. Is that because he chooses not to lie? Okay, well then, it can't be the truth if there's a lie. And if by definition God is truth, then there cannot be a lie. It just is a logical impossibility. It cannot be. Not that he chooses not to, he simply can't, because it's not within him, because he is the very essence of purity, of holiness. There is nothing in him that can go the other way. And so with this, because he is holy, we know that he is dependable. It is his character. It's his essence, I guess is the better word, because we'll talk about character in a second. It is his essence. So you don't have to be afraid that he's going to change. Now, the gods of Greece were extremely fickle. And there was always a fear. And this is one of the reasons when you read mythology, you're always having to try to please the gods, because the gods go from angry to upset, and you don't know what will set them off. And so everybody, in my opinion, should read Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, because it's just full of so much wisdom and understanding and other stuff. But anyway, it is a Greek mythology. But when you see these gods, they are so capricious. You never know what they're going to do, and if they're mad at you, and why they're mad at you, and how you get them to stop being mad at you. With this God, he's not fickle. He's not changeable. To me, one of the greatest characteristics of God is his faithfulness. Because his faithfulness gives me trust in the others, the other characteristics of God, his provision, His love, because I know he's not going to change. He says, I am holy, 100% pure. And then he says, he who is true. Then this is not a word here that means true as opposed to false, because we have that with the gods of Greece. False gods. Some are true, some are false. This is not about a true statement versus a false statement. This true here, this word, what it means is genuine versus fake. And we know about fake. That's been a thing that we've heard the last several years. When you know, anytime you turn on the internet and you read the news, well, is this fake news or is this news we can trust? Right? And what Jesus is saying, when he says, I am true, what he's saying is, I am the genuine article. There is nothing false in me. There is nothing fake in me. I am who I am. What I was yesterday, I'll be today. What I am today, I'll be tomorrow. You can depend on me, as opposed to the gods like Dionysus, like Apollo, these other gods, Zeus, that we've talked about all week long. And the next thing we see here is the position that he has. Not only is he holy and true, but he is the one who's holding the keys. Now, keys, what does that mean? Can I, just out of curiosity, because it's just us family, how many of you have a key to the church? Okay, there's a few of you. Now, you were given that key for a reason. I don't know if Brother B held a ceremony or anything like that, and you had to sign a piece of paper with all the long responsibilities. You had to take an oath. They take your blood type. Need to know, you know, all of those things. Because when you're given a key, that's a symbol of authority. You have the authority to open and shut that door. That's right. And if something comes up missing, they're going to say, okay, who had a key to that building? It's one of the first things the police are going to ask. Who had a key to this building when the copier walked off? There's a responsibility that comes with that authority. And it's not just given willy-nilly. Now, I've been in churches. I attended one church when I was young, and everybody in the church had a key. As soon as you were a member of the church, they gave you a key, and if you needed in, you came in. And that was a wild ride, I'll tell you what. And they finally had to, at the end of it, everybody had to turn their keys in, and they had just a few people with keys, and then everybody was mad. It was a difficult situation. But when we talk about he has the keys, he has the authority to open and to lock at his discretion. He doesn't have to call somebody else. When you don't have a key, you've got to call somebody else and say, I need into the church. Can you let me in? But when you've been given a key, you have the authority to open and shut. Now look what it says he has the keys to. Because we know in another place it says that I hold the keys of death and the grave. But here he says, I have the key of what? The key of David. Now why on earth is that exciting at all? What would the key of David mean? The authority of David. Well, who was David? King David. Okay, so we got to start there. King, that's a good place to start. First name, King. King David. And the rulers of Israel, there was a promise made to David about, and there we get your word again, the lineage of David. And anybody know what that promise is? That a descendant of David would be on the throne forever. And that came to be understood as a messianic promise, that the Messiah would come from the line of David. And so here is Jesus, and he's speaking and saying, I have the key, the authority of the King David. Now, what is the city of David? Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the city of David. It was David that took Jerusalem, made it the capital of Israel, and it became known and still is known today as the city of David, that original part up on Mount Zion, still called the city of David if you look at it on a map today. And so when he says, I have the key of David, what he is saying is that I have been given authority as the king and the king that will reign forever, and I have the key to the city of David. Now, what made the city of David so valuable to Israel? What was there? The temple. The temple. Not the palace. That's not what made the city so valuable. It was the temple. Now, what makes the temple so valuable? The presence of God. And so what he's saying here is saying, I have the key of David. He's saying, I have the ability to lock and unlock, to open and to shut the way into the very presence and place of God. Now, this is a pretty big thing to say, as he's saying here. I have the key to open and to shut the access to the presence of God. Now, do we see this anywhere in the New Testament at the death of Jesus? Anything that's related to this that you might be able to think of opening access and shutting access to the presence of God? Josh, you get extra points today. When Jesus was crucified, it said that the veil of the temple, which blocked access to the Holy of Holies, where the presence of God was, that veil was torn, and access then was granted to the presence of God. No more do you have to stay outside and wait for somebody else to go in and represent you. You have, because of the authority of Christ, you have access to that. And so when he says to this church, hey, I have the key of David, what they hear with that is a whole understanding of the one who has the access to the very presence of God and can reveal that to you. And look what it says, because not only does he have the essence of holiness, the character of truth, not only does he have the position of authority to have the key, but he also has the activity to use it. See, some people have an authority, they have a position, but they don't do anything with it. Right? There's people that probably have had a key to this church for 5 years and have never once used it. It just sits in there. It's there. They forgot they had it. And if Brother B says, I want all the keys, they're going, do I have a key? I haven't used my key in 15 years. You know, there are some people who are given a position of authority and never act on it. And sometimes we are tempted to look at Jesus in this way. We know that he has the ability, but we don't always trust that he will do the activity for us. And here is what he says. He says, I have the authority, but also, it doesn't say who will open or who has opened. It simply says who opens. He's not talking about I will act or I have acted. He says, I am. I am acting. And here's something that we need to remember. God is always working. God is always working. Jesus says this in the book of John. He says, my Father is always at work, and so am I. And one of the things that we need to remember is that as he not only holds the position of authority, but he is actually using it. And their history as a missionary city, remember that they are formed to evangelize the rest of the world for Greek culture. And as they have that, many of the Christians in this church understood what it means. I want us to look at this activity. Who opens and no one will shut. Who shuts and no one opens. Many of these Christians, and we're going to find from the rest of the letter, that they, like the church in Smyrna, are facing a lot of opposition from the Jewish people. These were people who knew what it was to have a door slammed shut in their face. If they were members of that Jewish community, as soon as they accepted the claims of Christ as Messiah and joined up with this little church over here in Philadelphia, the door to the synagogue was slammed in their face, right? And so they knew what it was for a man to shut the door. Many of our early Pentecostals felt this and knew this experience as well. My great-grandfather was a Baptist pastor for many years until 1927 when he experienced the baptism of the Holy Spirit, went back to his church, Findlay Avenue Baptist Church in Ottumwa, Iowa, went back there and shared with his church the experience that he had just had, that what had happened in the book of Acts had happened to him, and that night his deacons met and slammed the door shut in his face, out of a job, out of a parsonage. He had to reevaluate what he was going to do with the rest of his life. So he became a Pentecostal preacher. He kept doing what he was doing. He just added a little bit of oomph to it with the baptism of the Holy Spirit. But God opened the door to him when other men had shut one. Some of you here today know what it is to have somebody shut a door in your face. Absolutely. And sometimes they just shut the door in your face. And Jesus is saying, I have a key. And in that key, I have opened the door. And the door that I open, no one can shut. And it's interesting that Jesus says, man may shut the doors of earthly things, but I will open doors that no one can shut. Man may shut you out from their fellowship. They may say they don't want to be friends with you. They may not invite you to the guild meetings anymore, Dale. You may miss out on some of that. And there may be doors that are shut in your face of people who will not have fellowship with you, people who will not listen to you. But God says, I will open doors that no one can shut. And we need to let this description of Jesus Christ and who he is to this church encourage us today. Now, Here's a question that we need to look at, because he says, I know. Here's his I know statement about them. He just says, I know your deeds. He doesn't really describe what the deeds are. He just says, I know them. And behold, I've seen your deeds. Behold, I have put before you the one who opens doors and closes doors. I've put before you an open door. An open door which no one can shut. Now, I want us to look at a couple things here. He says, I have put before you an open door, which no one can shut. And then he says, because, and then three things that describe them. You have a little power. You have kept my word. You have not denied my faith. Now, I can't but help but ask the question. And in the Greek, the order of words is a little different here. And it begs a question. Is it because they had kept his word and not denied his name that he set before them an open door? Or is it that having already had an open door, even though they had a little strength, they walked through it in faithfulness and kept his word and did not deny his name? Which came first, the chicken or the egg? Was it the open door that came first and then they showed that they were faithful? Or were they faithful first and then they got an open door?
Yes.
Which one? Okay, faith opens the door. So maybe they showed their faith first and then got an open door. Okay. All right, we've got somebody waving a hand. Okay, we're not there yet. We're going to get there. We're trying to figure out which came first, the door or the faith? Okay.
Well, the terminology seems to say, behold, because you, I have.
Okay. So now in the English, and this is what threw me when I was reading it, because in the English, it certainly looks like that this came first because of this, then this happens. But in the Greek, the verbs are just a little different, and it looks like that when you saw you had this, then this is how you responded. And so here's what I have come to decide. Yes. I think the door is a revolving door. That's what I think. I think that God has his people, and when they came to him, he said, I'm going to give you an open door. Now, what you do with it, we'll see. We'll test what you'll do. He gave them an open door. They walked through it, proved themselves faithful, and guess what? After they had proved themselves faithful in that door, guess what they found? Another door. And after they walked through that one, showed themselves to be faithful, keeping his word, not denying his name, guess what they found? Another door. I think these are doors that just continue to open. And this is certainly how I have found it in my life. It's certainly how I've seen it in the lives of other people. Because sometimes God puts a door in front of you that you know you didn't earn. You know that you hadn't shown yourself faithful enough for anything like what God was, what the opportunity that he was putting in front of you. Have you ever found yourself in that place? You know that you weren't qualified. You hadn't proved a thing. And yet God puts in front of you this door and the opportunity. And this is something I used to have this sign over on, well, it was on the back of my door in my office at the church I pastored for 15 years in Council Bluffs. And it said this: the opportunity before you is God's gift to you. What you do with that opportunity is your gift to him. And there's some truth to that, because God will open doors for you. What you do with those open doors is up to you. So for these people, the doors of opportunity in God's economy, when he opened one and they saw it, they walked through it regardless of, look how it describes them. Okay, Deanie, so now we'll get to you. Because you have a little power. This is a little church in a difficult place, and yet they have a king who holds the key, the key. I mean, the king, David. He's got the key of David. He could open and shut access to the city of God, to the presence of God. And he has taken that key and has opened a door in front of you. And sometimes we see the door that he opens, and all we can think of is this right here. You have a little power. And we knock and it shall be opened. Have you ever knocked and God opened and then you realize you didn't have what it took to walk through? Feeling a little on the inadequate side? Oh boy, I sure have. God's put me in places and given me stuff to do that I know I'm not qualified for. That I know that in my own, I have a little bit of strength, but I don't have that much. And here's what we find. There is a promise that God made to Paul when Paul was in this place. And he wrote it to the Corinthians in his second letter that he wrote to them. He said this, here's what I have found. That in my weakness, that's when I find that God is the strongest. And God has been opening doors for his church throughout. One of the things that I can't help but see as somebody who's into church history and seeing this promise to a church, I have set before you an open door. This is a missionary city. This was their identity. This was their founding. This city existed for the purpose of showing the rest of Asia Minor what a culture could look like. And God says to a church that is countercultural to the culture that it's in, he said, you are a completely different culture, and I have put before you an open door to show the rest of Asia Minor what it can look like when somebody is a part of the culture and the kingdom of God. And here's what we find in church history, how wonderfully, and I wrote this down this morning because I was just thinking about this passage. I wrote this down, how wonderfully in each century, how the king has opened doors before his church. In spite of opposition, he has unlocked and flung wide open doors of opportunity for his people. In Paul's day, that door of opportunity, and coming up from where he was there in Antioch, the door of opportunity was right here in Asia Minor. And he went through all of these areas, through Galatia, through Colossae, Ephesus, all of these areas, that was the open door in his century. In the days of the early church fathers, the open door was in North Africa, where God began to raise up people who would help shape the theology of the early church in Egypt, in Carthage, and North Africa saw an open door in the time of Augustine of Canterbury. It was the British Isles, where here was a whole entire island of people that had never been reached with the gospel, and Gregory the Great looked at a young monk and said, I want you to go to this open door and I want you to see the British Isles become Christian. It was later in the time of early medieval history that the open door was the Germanic barbarians as they were coming across Europe and they met up with a Christian culture and they sought with that open door as God was bringing, and here's the thing, he was bringing invaders, and these Christians looked at their invaders as a mission field to convert those German barbaric tribes. In that time, it was the open door. In the time of Luther, the open door was the people who were already Christians but weren't fully following Christ. And that was his open door. When we get to the time of John Wesley, the open door was a newly forming colony in North America. In the 20th century, the open door that God placed before us was when he took down an iron curtain across the eastern part of Asia and opened up the doors to Russia, to Czechoslovakia, to Ukraine, to Romania, and knocked down those doors, that bamboo curtain across the Church of China that began to open in the 80s and 90s as missionaries were able to go back into there. Today, there is an open door before the Church of Jesus Christ in Latin America and in Africa, such as we have never seen. So can I tell you, when a missionary comes to your church and says, God has given us an open door of opportunity, you need to run with your offering. Because when that open door is there, we need, even though we have a little power, We need to respond just like this church did. But you have kept my word. You have not denied my name. Even though you were inadequate, you did not have what it took. Philadelphia was a church like all the other churches of its time. It existed in the middle of the corruption of paganism, surrounded by forces that kept trying to overwhelm it. Yet, even though they were in the same mess that Sardis was, Thyatira was, Laodicea was, yet in them, God says, I have given you a wide open door of opportunity. God has said that to us as well.
Yes.
There is an open door. I don't know what the open door to Point Assembly of God is, but it's up to us to find it. Where is the open door? Is it that there's a whole bunch of single moms that need some help working on their cars? Is it that there's a bunch of people over here who need help rebuilding a structure that you guys can help with? What is your open door? What's the place that you can look at and see God has opened this opportunity to us? And even though we may not be adequate, and here's the thing, because sometimes your pastor will come to the church and say, I believe that God is calling us to step out in faith to this opportunity here in our community. And one of the first thing a board says or a church can say is, well, we don't have what it takes to do that. You understand that, Pastor? We don't have the money. We don't have the networking. We don't know anybody. And we start listing all the reasons why we can't. But can I tell you that every open door that God has ever set before his church throughout history, they have always been inadequate for the task. John Wesley was no more adequate for the task of starting the Methodist church than a rock was. And yet, he was obedient, and he did it. There's an open door for Point Assembly of God. We just have to find it. And when he opens it, when we walk through it, well, I'm preaching instead of teaching, so we'll try to get back to teaching. But it's here. It's all right. Let's keep moving, or I'll get stuck here. He says, now this is interesting. He has said to them, I have set before you this open door, and there are conditions that are calculated to hinder this church. And we see these conditions here, because he mentions the same thing he mentioned at Smyrna. Remember Smyrna, the persecuted church? And he talked to them about the synagogue of Satan. He said, this is the source of your trouble. In Philadelphia, he uses the exact same term. This is the source of your trouble. These Christians have probably come out of the synagogue, accepted Jesus as Messiah, and now the synagogue has shut the door in their face, and they feel that ostracization, they feel that little power. But they're still continuing to be obedient. Here's what God says to them. I will cause those. In other words, I will bring about something that is going to happen that this will be the result. I will cause those of the synagogue of Satan who say that they are Jews, but they're not. Wow. Paul echoes this sentiment in the book of Romans. Paul, a Jew, a Jew's Jew, the kind of Jew. I mean, he's like big time Jew. And he makes the statement that the true Jews are those who accept the Messiah, because that was the purpose of the Jewish people as God brought them in, that he would bring through them a Messiah who would be the light to the nations, not just to the Jewish people, but a light to the nations. God's heart has always been for the nations, not just for a certain group of people. God forgive us when we think that God is focused on us. God's heart has always been for the larger, the bigger picture. And when he called out the people of God, the Jewish people, he set them to be a light to the nations and to bring the Messiah. But then when the Messiah came through them, they rejected him. But the whole point, the reason for being a Jew, was to accept that Messiah and then to spread that news to the rest of the world. So these people who are in the synagogue who have rejected the Messiah and are shutting out those who have accepted them, Jesus says they're not real Jews. They're claiming it because Abraham is their father. Ethnically, they have a Jewish lineage, but spiritually, they are not the people of God anymore. They are not a synagogue of the Lord. They have become a synagogue of Satan. And here they are still meeting, still going through the rituals, believing that they are pleasing God. Can a church fall into this trap as well? Of continuing the work, continuing to keep the doors open, to continuing to come, continuing to serve communion, to have baptisms, to have somebody standing in the pulpit. But they are so out of touch with what God is doing in their day and their moment that God is looking down at them and pleading with them, become my church again. Stop focusing on yourselves. I've called you out to be a light to the nations, not simply to come together and hear some nice teaching and go out and do the same thing you did yesterday. Because when we do that, he cannot give us an open door. Because see, he doesn't give us that open door until we've walked through this open door. He stops opening at the place of our disobedience. And this is what has happened for these Jewish people. He had set before them throughout all of their history open door after open door after open door. But once they closed that door to the Messiah, then no more doors opened because they're still stuck at this one. He stops opening the doors of opportunity at our place of disobedience. I will cause those. And then we get into a bit of a verse that's kind of difficult for us. He says, they are Jews, they are not, they lie. I will make them come and bow down at your feet. I will make them come and bow. Now, I don't know about you, but I kind of feel uncomfortable with that. I don't have this need for anybody to come and bow down at my feet. I personally, if you tried that, I would say, please don't do that. Stand up. I would just as soon you didn't bow down at my feet. But one of the things that we need to see here is that this certainly brings to our mind another picture of an Old Testament story. Do you remember anybody in the Old Testament who had been rejected and pushed aside, but God had given him a dream? Joseph. Remember Joseph? Now, Joseph wasn't real smart with his dreams. God had given him dreams showing him that his brothers, his mother and father, would bow down before him. Now, if he was smart, he would have kept that to himself and just held it. Sometimes God says something to us that we just need to hold on to and watch what he does. But Joseph couldn't do that. He had to go out and tell everybody, which caused him troubles. Ended up putting him in a pit, in a prison. But yet, that's exactly what God used to get him to the place where he needed to be. And this is the kind of picture that Jesus is painting here. Those who have rejected you, those who have shut the door, slammed right in your face, I am going to cause them to come down and to bow at your feet. And here's the point of it, so that they will know that I have loved you. See, this is not the language of anger. I'm going to cause them to come. They've been ugly to you. I'm going to cause them to come down and bow down at your feet, and you're going to be in charge, and you're going to lord it over them just the way they lorded it over you. That's anger and retribution. Have we ever seen that? You put me down, but boy, the tables are going to turn one day. And when it turns to me, I am going to show you what it really means to be in charge. But this is not the language of anger or retribution. These were people who were hindering the work of God and causing pain to the people of God. And God says, I'm going to bring them to your feet so that they will simply see that they were wrong. I do love you. See, these Jewish people that were pushing them out, they were saying, you are renegade Jews who have rejected the faith, and you are outside of God, and you are anathema to us. You are out of our kingdom. But God is saying, I'm going to show them that you're not out of the kingdom. You are the kingdom. And the purpose of this is so that when they come, they will see that I have loved you. And who ultimately gets the glory? Is it you? No, it's God. They're going to see, oh, these are the people of God. God is much bigger than we thought. Look at God. The goal is not for us to have people come and bow down at our feet so that we can get some get back. It's so God gets the glory, not us. Wow. And because you have kept the word of my perseverance, I also will keep you. You've kept me. I'm going to keep you. And this is an incredible promise. An incredible promise. Now, he says, I will keep you from the hour of testing. The hour of testing. Now, we need to think about some things in light of what how this first century people would have understood this. Now, we can see from the context of the text that it is most likely that there is a good portion of this particular church that has a Jewish background. Now, when a Jew hears this line, the hour of testing, we need to understand that Jewish people, their worldview, when they look at all of history, there are two time periods in all of history. They're described as this day and that day. The present age and the age to come. There's simply two ages. The one we're in and the one that will come. So we live in this one, but we look toward that one. So they're understanding two time periods, two days, this day and that day. So when we read in the scripture where they talk about, and on that day, that means that time period to come. But their understanding was in between this day and that day would come something that was called the day of the Lord. So we live in this day, and then will come the day of the Lord, which is a time of testing. It's a time when God comes to separate the good from the bad, the wheat from the chaff, all these things that Jesus talked about, the day of the Lord, and then the age to come when God's people will have authority and rule with him. So this is the Jewish understanding. Okay, they don't see all these epochs of time like this. They see this day and that day. And in the middle is the day of the Lord. So when he says, I will keep you from the hour of testing, what he is saying here, that hour which is about to come upon the whole world, how these people would have understood that is when the day of the Lord comes, that time when he is going to test and to separate the good from the bad, when that day comes, it says you don't need to worry about that because I will keep you. See, you've already passed the test. I've set before you open door after open door. You've walked through them. You've passed the test. I've got nothing bad to say on your report card. You've passed the test, so you don't need to worry about this coming day of testing. Because when it comes, you know that you can walk right through it because you've already got the A on your report card because of your obedience. And what God is saying to us here is we don't need to fear the coming of the Lord. We don't need to fear the judgment of the Lord. If God has already dealt with our sins, he's already judged them, and he has declared us clean, and we are walking in obedience, then when he comes, we just get to go, it's the day of the Lord. But if we have not passed the test, if our report card still says, well, about a C minus, or perhaps even an F, then the testing has to continue. And on the day of the Lord, all will be made plain. And so we need to be careful about, some people have taken this passage to talk about that this is a sign that says that the church will not experience tribulation or a time of testing or that a period of great tribulation that is coming, that the church will not experience that. Now, many people make that argument, but this isn't a good verse to make it from because this church would not have understood it that way. And so what he's saying here is that you have passed the test, and so when that day of judgment comes, you don't have to be afraid. You are already covered by me. I will keep you. You've kept me. I'm going to keep you. Does that make sense?
Yes.
On the hour that comes to test those who dwell on the earth, but you've passed the test. So you don't need to be tested again. All right. Then he goes on to say, I am coming. I am coming. He just simply says, I am coming. How many times in church history has God again and again taken his church and directed our gaze upward? What Jesus said to us in his last discourse there in the book of Matthew, when he's talking about earthquakes and troubles and trials, and he says, these are just the birth pangs. These are just the beginning of things. He says, when you see these things happening, what should you do? Look up. Does he say, when you see these things happening, you should hide? No. When you see these things happening, you should run in fear and go get into a hovel? He doesn't say that. When you see these things happening, look up, because these are signs that says, it's getting closer. It's getting closer. What if we lived in such a way that each morning we got up, went over to the window and flung it open and stuck our head outside and said, what a beautiful day for the Lord to come. And then when we came to bed at night, if he hadn't come that day, to go out there and look at the moon and say, oh, what a beautiful night for the Lord to come. What if he were to come while we were asleep? Honey, if he comes and you hear him first, wake me up. And then in the morning to simply get up, look, God did it again. He brought the sun up. He raised it. What a beautiful day for the Lord to come. Living in constant expectation. Behold, I am coming. Yeah. And I'm coming how?
Quickly.
Quickly. Now, one of the things that we get kind of confused here on this word quickly is that we think that that means he's saying to them a timetable. So I'm talking to you, and it's, you know, 70 to 90 or so A.D., and quickly, you know, they would have the quickly, he's coming now. But he's describing how the coming happens. When it happens, remember how he described it? He said it's going to come like a thief in the night, in the twinkling of an eye. When he comes, his coming is quickly. He's not establishing a timetable here. He's saying how it's going to come. When it happens, boy, you're going to go, wow, that was quick. Have you ever waited on God for something, and then once he finally started to move, you're going, wow, and you couldn't believe how quickly he moved? And that's what he's saying here. When I come, it's going to be quick. It's just going to happen, and you're going to be, I think the description is, you're going to be out going about your business, out doing over here, and all of a sudden, you're going to hear a trumpet blast. And at that last trumpet, the saints of God, can you imagine being in a graveyard at that moment? I've always thought that's where I'd like to be. I'd like to be in the graveyard because, you know, they get to go first, and so I get some warning. Because if the graves start popping open, I'm not going to think it's zombie time. It's the coming of the Lord. Because as soon as they go, then I get to go. And when it happens, when God begins to move, he moves quickly. I am coming, and when I do, it will be quick. Until that time, hold fast. Hold on. Hold on to what you have. Hold fast to it. See, the opposition is not over. Yes, I've set before you an open door, but you still live next door to the synagogue of Satan. So don't think that just because I've set before you an open door and I will keep you from being having to be worried about the judgment to come. Don't you think that it's going to be all that easy. You have got to hold fast. The opposition isn't over. Matter of fact, it may only be just beginning. And so you have to hold fast to what you have. Did I put that up? Yeah, to what you have. What do they have? Well, look at your text. What do they have? They got a little strength, right? So hold fast to that little strength you have. It may not be the strength that they have over there in West Monroe, but you know what? For what God's given you, the open door he's given you, you don't need the strength they have in West Monroe. You need the strength you need for here. Hold fast to what you have. They had a little strength. They had some faithfulness. Hold on to that so that no one will take your crown. Now, wait just a second. The crown that's given to them has been given. If you win a crown in the athletic competitions and that's placed on your head, nobody gets to come and just take that from you. And so we need to remember there, because sometimes this scares a few people, and sometimes this has been taken out of context to say that the devil has the power to to come into a Christian's life and to trip them up so much that they lose their victory. No, the devil can't take your victory. The only way to lose the crown that you have there is to take it off and lay it down, to forfeit, to stop the race, to simply say, you know, I've been faithful for a long time. He's told me he'd come quickly, but boy, I sure hadn't seen it. And I've been faithful, and I've been faithful. I've been working in this nursery for 35 years. I'm taking care of the grandbabies of the babies I used to take care of in the church nursery. I'm tired. I have served my course. I'm going to just lay down. Listen, don't die before you're dead. Don't forfeit. You may need to make some changes. My husband is the pastor of Maranatha Village in Springfield, Missouri. That is a retirement home for ministers and missionaries. So our entire congregation is in their 80s and 90s. And this is something that we deal with. Because we've got people in our congregation that opened entire nations for the gospel. But you know, sometimes even these folks can get tired. And there's times when they'll talk and say, you know, chaplain, I'm just tempted to lay down and let somebody else pick up. And we say over and over, don't die till you're dead. Don't die until you're dead. God has something for you. It may be just praying. It may be making some phone calls. It may be writing letters to somebody who's discouraged. But don't take your crown and forfeit it off when there's a door of opportunity before you. Even if you're 95, our assistant that's in charge when we're gone is 99 years old. He'll turn 100 next spring, and he's got dreams and plans of what he's going to do for his birthday and beyond. Don't die until you're dead. Don't forfeit your crown. Nobody can just take it from you. You have to hold on to it and keep it going, and don't forfeit it. And look at the promise, and then we're done. He who overcomes. Look what it says. I will make him a what? A pillar. Now, what would the people in Philadelphia think when they heard Jesus say, I'll make you a pillar? What would come to their mind? Those pillars that were filled. The temple was full of them. Pillars with the name of somebody that after they had died, the community said, we want to remember this person. Now, some people after they died, they didn't get no pillar because they didn't want to remember them. Right? Remember Paul there in Philippians when he writes to him and says, I thank God every time I remember you. There's some people, every time we remember them, we don't necessarily thank God. You got some people like that in your life? But Jesus is saying, just like when you see all of these pillars all over your town with names on them and all the things that they've done, I will make you a pillar in the temple, not of Dionysus, not of Apollo, not in one of these heathen temples. I will erect you a temple in the very house and the family of God. Not what just with your name inscribed on it, but we're going to see with God's name inscribed on it. Your name and God's name together. Imagine that God would put your name with his. It's always amazed me in the Old Testament that when God introduced himself to a new generation of Israel, he introduced himself by saying, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Jacob, the God of Isaac. Wow, imagine if God were to introduce himself to your great-grandchildren by saying, I am the God of James. I've added your name to mine. And that's what he says he'll do with this pillar. I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God. And look at this, and he will not go out from it anymore. What else do we know about these people? What are they used to doing in their city? Going in and out. They're used to fleeing out of fear. So first he promises them a position, and then he promises them security. You know, he didn't promise them freedom from death, but deliverance from the fear of it. That's what he's promised us according to the scriptures, who all their lives lived with the fear of death. He came to give and to set them free from that. Here's something that I have found in my life, because people sometimes ask me, you know, even though I'm married, I typically travel alone because neither one of us makes enough money for the other one to quit their job. So we both have to keep doing what we're doing. And my job is traveling. And I go across our nation and as well as around the world. I went to Turkey and Greece, and part of it I was with people, but part of it it's just little old me and my head covering trying to look for some Turkish guy that'll help me out and get me where I'm going to go. And sometimes people have asked me, how do you do that as a woman alone? Here's the answer to that, and I have found this to be true. Once you have dealt with the death question, and you understand, I'm going to die, and I have dealt with that, and when that day comes, the day of the Lord, I've already dealt with that, and so there's no fear of that. That removes the fear of death, because death is now just a ticket to the other side. So I've dealt with the death question, and when you've dealt with the death question, then you can really start to live. Because that fear is taken over. Because, well, what if I die? Oh, well, what if I die? I've got life insurance. I've already bought a burial plot. Because when we went to buy my daddy's, they were having a buy two, get one free. So I thought, well, you can't beat that. So I bought four and got two free. So I got my aunt and my uncle, my daddy and my mama, and me and my husband. We're already set. And a couple years ago, we decided, well, let's go ahead and put the tombstone in because we needed a place to sit when we were at the family cemetery. So we just put a bench, threw our names on it. We got a place to go. I'm ready. I'm ready. And because that's dealt with, then there's no fear to do some of these other things. Because you know that right here, that I will make you a temple and a pillar in the temple of my God, and the fear of the going in and out, you are going to have security. He didn't promise them freedom from death, but deliverance from the fear of it. You are a pillar that will remain standing when all the rest of the earth is shaking. That's a pretty good promise, wouldn't you say? Absolutely. All right, and I just wanted to show this because this is the only thing left standing of ancient Philadelphia, and I just think that is too cool, that the only thing left standing are a few pillars. I just think that's kind of cool. I will write on him the name of my God, the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem. One thing I didn't tell you before, do you remember when Tiberius gave them all that money to rebuild their city and set them free from taxes? As a thank you, they renamed their city. It was Philadelphia. And then as a thank you to Caesar for all of his benefits, they named the city, they changed the name officially from Philadelphia to Neo Caesarea, the new city of Caesar, as a way of saying thank you. They got a new name. So we have these inscriptions. Now, later there were some bad Caesars, and they didn't want to be known as the city of Caesar, so they went back to Philadelphia. But then this is a city who knows what it is to get a new name, the name of their God. When Tiberius was their God, they named their city after that. But now they have the city of God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God and my new name. Not only do you get a pillar with your name on it, but it's going to have my name. We got more there, but I'm just going on too much with this church because I really like it. After the letter, in 105 AD, Ignatius, one of the prominent bishops, and we have a lot of his writings, and that's why we know this stuff, because his writings were preserved, mostly by the Bishop of Smyrna. But when he was on his way to Rome for trial, where he was executed, he stopped off in Troy before he left and wrote a letter. We have an epistle to Philadelphia from Ignatius. And in it, here's how he describes their pastor. I love this. It says, I was amazed by this gentleman and at his ability to do more by silence than those who use vain words. I love that description. In 325, we see them represented at the Council of Nicaea, so we know they have some strength because they're going to the councils. Now, and in between, you see this, there's a 700-year gap here. In between, this church just faithfully served God as part of the Greek Orthodox Church. In 1109, Turkish forces came in. They have already taken several cities in the area. They attack Philadelphia, but Philadelphia is able to withstand the siege. In the 13th century, we see that the Church of Philadelphia is home to a famous hymn writer. We have several of his hymns still existing. And one of the most famous medieval Greek preachers, Macarius, who was given authority over Smyrna. So little old Philadelphia that has a little power. Their bishop by this point is given authority. The church in Smyrna is struggling, and so Philadelphia is given it. It retained its independence from the Turks for the longest of the seven cities, until 1390, when it was the last of the cities to fall before the Turks moved on to the capital. In 1671, a Western visitor who was there stated that, and this is during the Ottoman Empire, after the Muslim Ottoman Turks have taken over the area, a Western visitor stated that the Greek cathedral had been turned into a dump site for the entrails of slaughtered beasts, but that there were four small churches among the mosques. Just super quickly, when a Muslim force comes in and takes over a Christian city, historically, here's what they do. The largest of the churches is turned into a mosque. It's converted because that shows the authority. Now, they don't close down all the churches. The largest church will be converted into a mosque, and then they count the number of churches in the town. And as long as there is a ratio of 4-1 mosque to churches, those churches can stay open. So if there's four mosques in the church in the city, how many churches can we have? One. And so if there's a lot of mosques, you're going to see a lot more churches. That's just their practice. It wasn't that they closed down every church. The largest had to become a mosque to show who has authority in the town. And then there just has to be more mosques than there are churches. So in the church continued to have martyrs. I found two. In 1650, a man named Demetrius, who was a priest's son, actually converted to Islam, but then later rejected Islam. But when he returned to Christianity, was executed. The issue in most Muslim countries is not someone being a Christian. It's someone converting from Islam to become a Christian. That becomes the issue. The exact same thing happened to a Turkish Christian, Haji George, a century later. He had converted to Islam and then went back to Christianity. In 1785, there's reported eight churches. So if we're a 1-4, if there's eight churches, how many mosques should we have in town? All right. There you go. In 1829, there are roughly 1,000 to 2,000 Turkish-speaking Christians in this city. In 1860, we see five active churches, though the large churches lay in ruins. Nothing was built over them, but there's five active churches. But since 1922, this is when Ataturk came over, formed the modern state of Turkey, and Greek Christians, and this is why we see so much animosity between the Greeks and the Turks. Thousands of Greek Christians were massacred at that time in 1922. Since then, there have only been a handful of Christians in Philadelphia. And they have a little strength, but they also have an open door. And God is good. And I think that open door is a revolving door. When you walk through what he gives you with faithfulness, he'll open another one. Are you adequate? No. But he is. He is. Don't ever look at your money, look at your education, look at your background and think, God can't use me. Oh, yes, he can. Tammy, do you have a question? What is a mosque? All right. A mosque is a religious center for the Muslim religion. It's not where you come for services. Like, we come to a church and we have services like this. To come to the mosque is where you come for prayer. So in Islam, you're required to pray five times a day. If you can get to a mosque, that's where you go. If you can't get to a mosque, if you're in a Muslim city, there's a little minaret, a tower, where the call to prayer, anytime you're in a Muslim city, listen for this, it'll happen five times a day, and you'll hear a call from that. It's in Arabic, so unless you speak Arabic, you won't understand it. But it's the call that says it's time to pray. If you're near a mosque, you go to the mosque, and you bow down toward Mecca and pray. If you're not, you just simply stop where you are. So you'll find in airports, if you go through an airport, oftentimes you'll find Islamic prayer rooms where if it comes to the time to pray, you can slip away in there and pray. So you see them in airports. But in larger cities in our state, there's mosques where you can go for prayer. So that's an Islamic religious center. But they don't come for a service like we have today. It's simply the place to come for prayer. And who are they praying? They pray the name of God in Arabic is Allah. And so they will pray to Allah. And that's the name. It's not a sometimes people think, well, that's a separate God from Jehovah. Allah is simply the all-supreme being, and that's his name in Arabic. And so they pray Tu'ala. There's five things. Can I name them? Everything that Muslims are required to do. They pray five times a day. They have to give alms. They need to make a pilgrimage to Mecca. And two other things. And I'll look them up and find them out for you. But it might be something to ask. You know, maybe here in the church you could do some study on other world religions to understand it. Because Islam is growing in the world, and it helps us to understand it. It has to be. To convert a church to a mosque, there's a process for that, because anytime an Islamic army conquered a city, they had to go to the largest church and they had to desecrate it and reconsecrate it. That's called converting. So we talk about converting a church to a mosque. So, for instance, the largest church in the Byzantine Empire was the Hagia Sophia in Constantinople. In 1453, and y'all can leave when you're done. In 1453, when the Ottoman Turks captured that capital city of Constantinople, they went into the priests on the day. It was October the something, 1453. And the emperor, the priests, had run to the safety of the Hagia Sophia. They were in the middle of prayers when the Muslim hordes broke into the Hagia Sophia, desecrated the building. The high altar was used as a bed to rape the nuns. They took the priestly garments. They massacred the priests, took the priestly garments, wrapped them around the dogs that were coming through. They opened the doors, allowed the dogs in, put the priestly garments on the dogs. And it was a Tuesday when they took the city, and the leader, Sultan Mehmed, said that by Friday he wanted to have Friday prayers in the Hagia Sophia. He gave that army from Tuesday to Friday to completely desecrate and convert the Hagia Sophia, the Church of Wisdom, into a mosque. And they did it. But they did it so hurriedly that in whitewashing, because of course in there you're going to have, if you've ever been in an Orthodox cathedral, beautiful paintings all over the wall, frescoes and all of that. And they whitewashed all of that. But over the years, they've had to continue to whitewash it because the crosses and the symbols keep coming through the whitewashing. So there are places today. When I was in the mosque in March of this year, there were places that you could see the crosses on the wall coming through, and they just repaint over those things. It's written. Well, and yes, now they're going to put, if they're turning into a mosque, they'll remove the steeple, but they'll put a minaret, which is the tall thing. And there's some reasons architecturally why they do that, but I won't keep you because I'm looking at the time and I have talked for way too long. But those are good questions. Allah is the name of their God. Now, to say, okay, he's a false god and equivalent with like Apollo or something like that. Allah is simply the Arabic name for God. Now, their understanding of Allah, their understanding of God, is not the same as the understanding of the God of the Bible. So in that, it's not the same. The God that they worship is not the same. But to say Allah is a separate God, Allah is simply the Arabic word for God. But he's not the same as the God of the Bible. There are differences. It's, yeah, and sounds like maybe a course in world religions would be fun. All right. Anything else, or are you all just hungry and being polite now? Lord, we thank you that you preserved this letter to this church. God, you've set an open door before Point Assembly of God. Lord, help us to be faithful. We have a little power, but that's all we need. Lord, would you show us clearly what our door is, and then may we be faithful to step right through it in your strength and faithfulness. Amen.